Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. Well, I'm really excited today to bring you Isaac Slade. I had a moment about a month ago when I heard Isaac play for the first time at Vashon Center for the Arts. It was a benefit, and I actually didn't know him by name. But when he went to the piano and started to play the first song, I heard a hush in the audience. Like, it was one of those, oh, wow, moments. And then when he played his second song, How to Save a Life, I lost it, because that song has been so important to me for so many years. So sure enough, Isaac Slade, the former rock lead singer for The Fray, has moved to Vashon, where he is now a regular guy, man on the street, dad taking care of his kids, and owner of a great new vinyl record store, Side Stack Records, which happens to be next door to Voice of Vashon. So Isaac, super thank you so much for coming in early today so
You're
we could
welcome.
Do this
yeah.
interview.
It's great to be here, Sally. Thanks.
Yeah. I'll tell people just a little of your background, even though it's probably known to many. You're an American musician and community leader, and you were the lead singer of The Fray for 20 years. That band was a Grammy-nominated multi-platinum rock band with a debut album, How to Save a Life, that sold 3 million copies worldwide. The band toured the globe for 20 years, releasing 4 albums and a greatest hits record. Isaac now co-chairs a music education initiative in Colorado and works with several organizations in the fight to end human trafficking. He's currently working on a variety of other entrepreneurial and creative projects, including running the vinyl record shop on Vashon Island, Side Stack Records. So thanks so much again. And how is Vashon treating you?
Perfectly.
Perfectly.
Yeah, it's a warm, welcoming community, especially if you live here full time. I think for a long time, people knew I had a house in Denver because this was just kind of our vacation spot. But, we stopped going to Denver almost immediately and this became our full-time thing. But I remember when we sold our house in Denver, all of a sudden people were like, hey, we should get a beer sometime. I was like, okay, now I'm in.
So how long ago did you first get your summer place on Vashon?
We bought a little place. It was fall. It was winter of 18. So it was right before COVID. It was like
a
year before COVID.
So you've been on and off the island for a while.
Yeah, we bought it in December of 18 and we were here full time by March or something like that of 19.
Okay. Yeah. And did the music community slowly find out that you were around and start connecting with you? Or were you incognito for a while?
I mean, yes and no. It was kind of right away. I reached out to Martin Fevrier. I just like Googled him and recognized some of the stuff he worked on and emailed him and, within weeks of being here. And he was like, great, meet me at Snap. We'll hang on a Sunday morning. And, over the course of 90 minutes, his family and my family hung out and he introduced me to like 50 people that morning.
Oh,
probably.
My gosh.
And he was like, Martin.
So tell me, because I'm not hip, who's Martin Fevrier?
Martin is a really well-known producer, kind of did a bunch of grunge stuff in the 90s. He's British. He's in a glam band that covers T-Rex and David Bowie. He plays on Island every once in a while. He played New Year's the last few years. But he's incredible. He has a wonderful studio out here and people kind of travel from all over to work with him. He's kind of one of the two like main sound guys. If you ever go to a live venue here with a musician of note, it's usually Martin behind the soundboard with his little reading glasses and snarky accent.
Amazing. amazing. That's so cool. So one question I had for you was, when you walk downtown on Vashon, what's the identity that's running in you? Are you the former rock star, or are you the dad rushing to get something at Thriftway because your kids are going to need it? When people see you on the street, who do you feel like you are?
I mean, in a beautiful way, I'm a couple things at once. The track coach came up to me and said my son ran the 800 really quick, and he was super proud of him. And then Brett over at Thriftway, she always comes over to the record store on Mondays after her shift, and whenever she sees me, she gives me a huge hug. I'm just like the dude that owns the shop. And then every once in a while, you know, a fan or somebody will come up and, you know, thank me or ask for a picture or something like that. And then I sort of have to like remember, like, oh yeah, right, I'm that guy too. But anybody kind of on the pursuit of mental health is doing that work of integrating all of those different parts into your, you know, every moment. And for a couple of years on Vashon, I had to kind of dry out to let that really loud kind of applause fueled identity simmer down a little bit, because it was so dominant in my everyday life for, you know, at least 15 years. There was a couple of years in the beginning of the band where I was a barista and we were all in college, that it wasn't that loud of a thing, but pretty much from 2004 to 2017, it was a freight train, and I was either driving it, sleeping in it, or holding on for dear life. And you know, that quickly became my identity. So coming here was a huge part of my healing, just to kind of normalize a little bit and have people either not recognize me or recognize me and not care, or care for the right reasons. Like, hey, good job on that stuff. What time are you doing carpool? You know, like it really helped me normalize. I've never lived in a small town as an adult. So it's been cool having the old timers and the kids and everybody in between. Just kind of, I'm 43. I'm smack dab in the middle, and I am feeling good.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great. And Vashon's happy to have you.
Thanks.
Happy to have you, because I have a sense that you're already contributing both through benefits like the VCA thing that you did and also running a record store. That's pretty cool. It brings people to the island. It's cool. It's a place to hang out, and it's beautiful. I walked in the other day. It's
Thank
really
you.
Great. In your interview, I think, with King 5, you talked about you know, wanting to leave the band for mental health reasons. You've been public about that. How, besides just chilling here, what have you needed to do to calm down that other identity, to let yourself reintegrate, whatever word you had for it?
Yeah, maybe the analogy would be, if you as a person are a house, and you got a bunch of issues in the basement or the garage that are just packed floor to ceiling, Hoarders episode style, it's okay to host a party as long as you like leave all that packed up. And if somebody's like, hey, do you mind if I sneak out into the garage to smoke? You know, you're like, sure, just don't touch anything. But it's, you kind of have to stay in like keep it together mode. And I think for a lot of years that worked for me. But as I started realizing that was limiting me, both in my, you know, personal relationships and in my concerts, those were the two areas that I really noticed this kind of invisible barrier, this ceiling. I realized, like, I gotta see what's in that basement, because every once in a while the door rattles. It's kind of strange, like something's in there. And then I would start having these kind of anxiety moments that led to, you know, panic attacks, that led to total overwhelm and kind of personal meltdown here and there, randomly.
Was that when you were on stage or off stage?
Both. Some of them would kind of happen after the show when I let down, but then they kind of started creeping into the concerts themselves. And then,
take me into that. What's it like to go out on stage and face an adoring audience, and also risk a panic attack? What? How did it come on when you were out in front of folks?
Well, I'll finish that train of thought and then I'll come to that. So the analogy would be, I would start going to therapy and then like opening that door a little bit and kind of walking through with a professional, like, what's this pile of boxes or kerosene soaked rags? What, you know? And then I'd have to get on a plane and go play in front of a bunch of people. So I'd have to like quick pack it up real quick. So I did a bunch of work and therapy and, you know, personal journaling and all that stuff. But I kept having to like pack it up before the party started again. So I think moving to Vashon was a part of a season of quiet that I needed to unpack everything and just like declutter and really unpack the garage and leave it all in the driveway for a couple months without having to kind of pull it together and get in front of people and be composed. But, you know, I think there were a couple arenas. I would have said, there's a couple random arenas that kind of stress me out, but everywhere else I'm comfortable. And I think what was happening was the opposite. It was more like I was able to mask everywhere except a few arenas where it really called for my full self. So I was able to hang with casual friends, but then when I was like one-on-one with a really close personal friend, I kind of fell apart. And I think now it's because like masks only work at a distance. And then in the creative life, whether I was trying to write or whether I was trying to perform, I could kind of phone it in and autopilot a show. And I got really good at it. I mean, I could get a crowd on its feet with some kind of scripted routine tricks. But it never got to that next plane of, you know, transcendence. But then if I was able to kind of drop the mask, then, man, people would just start weeping and I'd feel like I was levitating. And it was just, I was a prism for the gods to pour through me into the band and back to me into the crowd and back to me. I mean, so I realized there was a couple arenas that I wanted so badly to be myself. It was worth kind of taking that mask off. And then it trickled down. Like I started having panic once that mask was off and realizing like, oh my God, I got so many issues. and they're coming out at really awkward times when 21,000 people are staring at me and I can't feel my face. So that was kind of the football play of it all. I realized, you know, there's these places that I really want to bring my whole self and I'm not able to.
Yeah. You think that was true of other members of the band and the other musicians that you know that they have to struggle to be able to manage being their true self and going out in front of thousands who have a set of expectations about them?
Yes and no. I mean, anytime anybody gets up in front of a group of three people or more, I think everything tightens a little bit and you feel, you know, wary that you're going to be judged or you're going to fumble. But for the main microphone, like the singer, mm-hmm. It's kind of another level. And I've talked to other singers about this. It's not like I'm not whining about it. It's more like if I do my job right, if any singer does their job right as a human and as an artist, they are undressing a little bit and showing people what's underneath in a way that like a drummer just has the luxury of not needing to do. A drummer can do that, but they don't have to. And most people aren't drummers, so they don't know, like, oh, that drummer is being a little inauthentic. They're relying on old cliche drum beats or something, whereas a singer is engaging in such a human activity that we're all so familiar with. Or an actor, like, you know when an actor is really cheesy because they're just like, hi, I am sexy, do you want me? It's like, come on, dude. We know that space as humans from an audience perspective so well. The singer can't really get away with much unless everybody's like in on it, you know, like it's like, okay, cool. And like, I'm thinking of like some performers that get known for sort of a front, and in a cool way. Like, I mean, you know, watch the Beach Boys. There's just like this feel-good surfer thing, and everybody loved it, and everybody kind of bought it. And then when they got to Pet Sounds, they dug into this whole new depth of artistry that people didn't even know what to do with. So it's almost like that, where you can put on a show, no problem, kind of Las Vegas style, and people feel good about their $40 that they spent, and they get a beer. But to really like touch people deeply, you kind of have to sit down and show up.
I get it. And your music wasn't, as I'm no expert, but it seemed like a number of your songs had a depth to them. It could take people deep. And so if you're not deep, how can you offer that kind of music?
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. Yeah. Yeah, it's like if the singer or the actor or even the author reading their book to somebody in a live reading, if they settle in at a certain authenticity level and depth, that's the mark. Nobody's going to go deeper than that. So if you come in and be like, "Hey, I'm awesome. Do you want to buy my record?" People will meet you at that.
Yeah.
But you know, my songs and maybe my personality, just always had me striving for this sweet spot of kind of falling apart in front of everybody, and setting that watermark at setting that water level at a very vulnerable place. So I mean, in a sense, it's almost like people looked at me and thought, gosh, I'm nowhere near as much of a wreck as he is. I guess I can go there mentally and emotionally. And then people would just start crying.
Yeah, I get it. This is Sally Fox, and I'm speaking with Isaac Slade, former lead singer for The Fray, now record store owner with Side Stack Records on Vashon. What is it like to have produced a hit that's almost bigger than you are, that will probably, it'll be with your fans for the rest of their lives, and it may be with you, you know, the song or songs that people expect of you and go places that you don't even know they're going to go. And I'm thinking about How to Save a Life,
yeah,
because to me that song is sort of transcendent. Mm-hmm. It's bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And you've written about or spoken about how people will come up to you and say things that are so moving about how it may have saved a life.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's huge. And so when a song is out there and it has a life of its own, but it's also attached to you, what's that like to have your creation out in the world like that?
I used to have a really simple answer to that because people would ask me that a lot. And now I probably have three that are all competing. One is like a blue collar one. Like, I used to make $7 an hour. So to think about being able to sit down with my buddy and bust out this 4-minute tune that is going to put my kid through college and probably his kid through college is like staggering. I feel so fortunate, and my fans have given me something that I will treasure for the rest of my life. And then on a sort of like a monk level, it effed me up so profoundly to make that much of an impact at 26, 27. It's almost like everything's downhill from there. And I've, you know, maybe I'll have another hit someday, but I've certainly never had another hit that big. I've had 4 quote unquote hits, but the first one was the biggest one. I guess it was the second one. The first one was pretty big, and then the second one was How to Save a Life. But I told a buddy, it's like I had a carrot on a stick. I was chasing just like everybody. And you're supposed to sort of like get nibbles and then maybe get it at 60 and sell your company and retire. I got it so young and so ungrounded. And I ate it, and then I woke up the next day like more hungry and like midlife crisis at 27 ensued. And it really messes you up when you get that much success and everybody's like, "Hey, congrats, you're set for life." And inside is just like terror and panic and anxiety, knowing like it wasn't enough. Like, what do you do after that? That next day is just horrifying. And I, you know, I wish all of my friends success. But I don't think many people realize how profoundly disturbing that kind of success is.
Was there a third?
Yeah, I think the third one is probably on a creative lightning rod in a field level. It was thrilling to show up as a aspiring artist. Well, no, as an artist aspiring to do it as a job. And lightning struck so hard and so loud and so fast. You know, this little band in the suburbs of Denver, all of a sudden we're playing on stages in countries that people don't speak English. And I can hear the accent as the crowd is singing along with me in Osaka and in Croatia. I mean, it's just crazy. It felt so satisfying to know that, especially the three or four big songs we had were songs of substance and impact instead of like a ringtone ready pop feel good hit of the summer. And I know people, unfortunately, who have their big signature songs kind of low on their pride list. And they just have to obligatorily play these tunes that, you know, eventually like they get so cranky and they just stop playing. And then all these people come out to see them and they refuse to play the hit. Cause you know, so I feel really fortunate from an artist standpoint that the biggest songs are actually my favorite songs that we've ever written.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little odd seeing, because sometimes here on the island we get aging performers who are working in smaller venues. Yeah. And, you know, watching Roger McGuinn play, and people came out because they wanted the Roger of so many years ago, not the Roger who was 80 years old, mm-hmm. and whose voice had failed a little bit, mm-hmm. but had great stories. So mm-hmm. it was a good evening. But always that place that he walks into is, would you play the for us?
Yeah.
That, you know, for 50 years or whatever he's had to carry around.
Did he play Tambourine Man and all that?
He did. Yeah. He did. And it was great. And, you know, people got it was expected. You know, people had it. And yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a certain sadness. I can't explain it.
Yeah. You know? I worked his show one time in college because I was like part of the student tech staff that he came in and played, and I had to set up his guitar and hand it to him, and I could tell, I mean, that was 20 years ago, I could tell he was not excited about being there. And I have off days. It could have very well been an off day, but I think with that situation, I mean, I might be in that situation in 20 years, call me, but I really relate. Like, There's a mix of love and obligation and exhaustion and thrill that all kind of gets mixed into this weird cocktail of, I have to play this song.
Yeah.
I like that people want to pay me to do it, but I don't love how I feel when I do.
Well, I know as a non-musician, but a creator, the moment that I start doing it for the money, you know, even if it's consulting or coaching or the kind of work I've done, it's suspect, you know, because if I can't find that love, if I can't genuinely be excited to be doing what I'm doing, it's not the same.
That's interesting.
And I feel that with my creative work. I feel like as long as I'm connected to a certain kind of spirit, a certain kind of, I really love doing this, then I can detach a little bit about how are they going to love it and what's That's the product's cool. going to be like. But if I don't connect here, then I'm vulnerable. I'm vulnerable because then it's all about what are they going to think about it.
Mm. Mm. That's good.
This is Sally Fox, and I'm speaking with Isaac Slade, former lead singer for The Fray, now record store owner with Sidestack Records on Vashon.
Yeah, I kind of have controversial views of art and commerce that I've gotten into pretty heated debates with friends about. That I see it as a kind of a dimmer switch, not an on-off. I know people that keep their art as pure as humanly possible. One buddy like has a number of times. He'll play his song 50 times and then he's done. And he refuses to play it anymore just to preserve the art. And then I know another guy that does not give a care or a second thought to anything he has to do to make money. And, you know, you ask him his music goals and he gives you a dollar figure. Like, so I know both extremes. And I'm probably dead center between those two, where I remembered early on thinking, if we open ourselves up to the industry side of this, two really significant things could happen. One is that we could quit our jobs and maybe do this for a living and, you know, essentially, if it works, get these songs out to a ton of people because it's going to be on like a Target commercial or something. And the second thing could happen is that we could, you know, lose our way and get totally reoriented around profit rather than impact or rather than, you know, beauty. And then we kind of just threw caution to the wind and tried it. And both absolutely happened. I mean, we lost our way 6 times probably. But we always just kept aiming towards something of the two of them together out of a kind of a blue collar place. Like if we're fortunate enough to make songs that pay, we can quit our jobs and just do this full time. That means, you know, we can support our families and we can make more music and maybe even play in Sydney. I mean, who knows? You know, we opened ourselves up to this gray that was between the black and white. That was like a huge pain in the butt to like, it was 16,000 small decisions that we would not have had to face if we stayed local, if we stayed working. You know, my buddy was a auto damage estimator, and the drummer and guitarist were like literally working together at an ice cream shop, and I was a barista, and it would have been so simple just to stay in those lanes and put out pure 7-minute songs if we wanted. But I loved that we got to like navigate the ups and downs. And the very first meeting we had with the label was like, how do you guys feel about taking your wedding rings off for this music video? Because it would sell a lot more. And not, you know, I was like, this is it. This is the crisis. They're going to tell you, we have to, you know, fight. And you know, 1,000 moments like that where we had to face, and I'm so glad we wrestled with that because it, you know, it yielded a ton of cool things, including, you know, making a living for 20 years, sitting around writing songs and playing them for people.
Yeah, and your kids' college education has probably been handled. So
yeah, exactly.
That's good. I was kind of surprised to read that initially people called the Fray a Christian rock band.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think about that as you were starting out, or was that a label that they put on you?
I thought about it a ton, but how to avoid it. I mean, we all grew up in church, in Christian Protestant church, and we all grew up playing in churches first, and then we all were in Christian rock bands before the Fray. Joe, my bandmate who started the Fray with me, was the lead singer of Fancy's Showbox. That was like the hottest band in my high school. And my band was probably 5th or something with the other two guys in the Fray. The three of us were in this like Christian band called Ember, based on some Bible verse. And that culture, I think, comes through once you're steeped in that. Like it's kind of always, you know, it's like staining something with a tea bag. You always have this kind of feel. And then we also did. The very first press we were ever able to get was with this big Christian magazine. It's like the biggest Christian magazine. And I really wish we waited for like a year before we did that, because for basically the first 18 months, if you Google us, that was the first thing that came up. So a lot of people just started kind of perceiving, and we talked about it a lot. We're like, yeah, we grew up playing in church. That was the only gigs we could get.
But you never did I don't think you, the kind of preachy Christian music that kind of gives it a bad name for some of us, like, you believe this or you'll be damned or whatever.
Yeah. It was only by association. And if anything, I very consciously distanced ourselves from that. That first interview we did, like day one, basically, was the only Christian interview we ever did. We never played in churches or anything. And this funny thing happened where the Christian industry, who I have tons of friends in, and it's a beautiful culture in a lot of ways. They started embracing us, which was cool. It was good for sales. It was good for spreading the word. But then they started kind of digging their nails into us a little bit and then kind of claiming us. And that really pissed me off because they like rejected us for years and years and years because we weren't playing in churches. We were playing in bars. And then all of a sudden we're big and they're like, oh yeah, these people are ours. I was like, F you. I messed with them. And on our second record, our big hit, it was about God. I just like went for the jugular. And I talked about getting in a fight with God, like finding him on a street corner. And I remember putting these two lyrics in that I knew were going to like not get us, they were going to keep us from getting played on Christian radio.
What were the lyrics?
I mean, you don't need much to get banned from Christian radio. I mean, you could basically not say the word Jesus and you're an uphill battle already. But then I used the word damn, like damn near, whatever I said. I made God, this Springsteen-y kind of street corner guy smoking a cigarette. And I remember getting this email probably 6 months into that second single. It's called You Found Me. That second album, we got this email that this big Christian radio conglomerate had requested the kids' Disney edit that we had made, but it didn't have the word damn and it didn't have a cigarette. And I thought it was hilarious that the Christian radio can only play the child approved version of the song. That's how whitewashed that culture can accidentally become. Oh, it made me so happy.
yeah, I get it. Oh, you know, the thing, when I listen to your music, for me, I feel like there's, if you call spirituality that which takes you to your core, mm-hmm. and really stirs a sense of longing. And
yes, 100%.
Then I really sense that in your music. And so in that sense, not in the Christian music sense, but in the faith sense, how did your faith influence your music or music career?
Hugely. I mean, it influences every moment of my day. And I think it naturally influenced our music. Yeah, spirituality is the word for me, I think. And the word Christian, just like the word Buddhist or the word Hindu, it I think everybody knows there's two versions of each one. Like you don't necessarily talk about it, but I think deep down everybody knows that there's the rule, behavior, fit the mold side, and then there's the heart and soul for real side. And you can almost tell just by like eating out with somebody to see how they treat the server. I mean, there's simple tests. It's like a sniff test of like, I don't care how smart you are or how many books you've read, like, or books you've written. If you're an a-hole to that like 19-year-old kid who's trying really hard to get your soup on time, like you're missing something. And I don't care what your academic or religious background is, you're missing the point. So from that standpoint, spirituality is, I think when you are aware that you have a spirit, I believe you have a spirit, and that person also has a spirit, and then everything outside of that, everything downstream from that is anybody's guess, you can live from and connect with people on that level. It's a game changer, and it changes the way you make art. It changes the way you talk to your kid when they come home drunk from prom. I mean, it changes everything. And, I think our music, ever since I started singing, I was like 11, and I remember feeling like, oh, that was a spiritual thing. Like I sang and it was spiritual. When I throw a football, it is not spiritual. No, I mean, I know when Tom Brady does, it probably is. Like, when I throw a football, nobody says, wow. But when I sang, I remember thinking like, oh, that's my thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've also gone on to do some, you've done substantial community work or volunteer work or support for the Governor's Initiative, mm-hmm, in Colorado. Mm-hmm. Are you still a part of that music education project?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was in that? I mean, what pulled you into that work?
I think a couple things, but mainly I always had this sense that, like, if you get enough money to pay your rent or your mortgage, and then kind of get the grocery bills covered, you do have this kind of obligation to start looking for ways to authentically contribute to the grand experiment that we're all in here. We don't live under a king who's like covering our every needs. Like, there's a contribution that needs to be made, and I don't think there is much of an obligation for a 26-year-old like desperately trying to like work their three jobs and like remember their girlfriend's name or birthday. Protests and all that's great, but at a certain point in your late 30s, whenever you get to that kind of stable point, I think it's really important to find ways that you can not pitch in. It's more like we're all trying to move this ox cart down the field in our country and all the way down to our little communities.
Yeah.
And if there's a way to help you, it's not that you should. It's more like you get to join the ranks of the older people who have a minute to give back. So for me, I started looking around. I knew the governor since he was the mayor, and he made a profound impact on my music and on my life. He was a really artist-focused governor, and he approached me and asked if I would lead this music initiative that he wanted me to kind of pull out of thin air of making Colorado the first state where every kid could learn how to play music if they wanted. And, you know, we identified it as K-12. That's a kid. We identified public, private, homeschool, incarcerated, other as about 1 million kids. And we put about 10 years on the clock for getting it. And we're in year 7 right now, 7.5. And I think we're going to get it by year 9. So we're close.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great because in so many places, music and art education have been cut back in mm-hmm. favor of, you know, hard stuff or because of budget cuts.
Yep.
And when you look at the world today, you think music and art, oh my, we need something that will fill our spirit and give people a chance to express themselves in different ways. Otherwise, it's my point of view, but I think the arts are so important right now.
I agree.
For kids.
I agree. And I think maybe one of the missing pieces I've seen, you know, from my little kind of poorly educated view is science and math and finance and even history to some extent, or it's kind of the traditional tech, all those kind of traditional, if you do this, you'll make money, academic priorities matter. They absolutely matter. I want the guy that designed the bridge I'm driving across to, like, know calculus. This is a good thing. But when we prioritize that at the expense of the art, philosophy, maybe history belongs on that side. When we over-prioritize the STEM side, we quickly lose the meaning of it all. Like, we can put a rocket in space, but we don't know why. We do not know what we're doing it for, other than like beating Russia or something. It's like you drop to the common denominator of like dominance without the arts. The arts are what are really what inform us of what things are for. So I get it. If I was a senator in charge of budgets and my kids are like 50th in the nation for math, it's like, let's not do a recorder flute budget. But at the same time, in a more of a meta sense, like, I really think we're losing that. We're losing the plot on that side of things.
Yeah, and this is for me personally, but I think it applies to others, that in times that are rough, where there's so much change, whether it's because of pandemic mm-hmm. or global conditions we really don't want, we can do our little thing to try and change that, but we have to kind of feed our soul. Mm. Otherwise, there's such a possibility for despair out there. You know, war, politics, whatever it might be. So to be able to have a place that you can come to and feel like, I'm still an agent, I can still create, I can still connect with some depth in myself and offer something from there, to me, it's super healing. It kind of keeps you going. At the same time, you do the other stuff you need to do. So
that's beautiful. Yeah, and it's almost, it's not quite this simple, but it's almost like the masculine energy is see, act, do, enter, you know, go. And the feminine energy is more about the giving and receiving and the experiencing and the metabolizing of the pain or the pleasure. And if you squint, I think the West in general is very masculine and very linear and very Excel spreadsheet. And that has its place. If you have $1 billion and you need a surgery, you go to Germany, you go to the U.S. But where we excel on that side, you know, on the opposite end, we really struggle with kind of the soul side of things and the soft touch side and the, okay, this is the Louvre, but what do I feel? What am I actually experiencing? What does this awaken in me that I can bring to my actual Tuesday? And I mean, you go to the East, I mean, they excel at that. I mean, they're really good at sort of like, yeah, but like, are you tasting your actual food right now? It's like, no, I'm right in a rush. So I think, you know, artistry, I mean, when it comes to, you know, budget priorities and stuff like that, we're right in line with the West's
priorities. I worked in different parts of the world and I love it. You know, like in India, go to a business conference, folks sing. Everybody sings because everybody sings. Or you go to Africa, everybody dances. And there isn't this thing of, oh, these people sing, but the rest of us, we can't sing. Or these people dance, but we can't dance. Totally. All that kind of mentality that's come in to our culture that is wrong. I mean, it's just not even true. And it diminishes us on some level because we all sing. We all dance. We all, you know, create.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. You know, like in India, go to a business conference, folks sing. Everybody sings because everybody sings. Or you go to Africa, everybody dances. And there isn't this thing of, oh, these people sing, but the rest of us, we can't sing. Or these people dance, but we can't dance. Totally. All that kind of mentality that's come in to our culture that is wrong. I mean, it's just not even true. And it diminishes us on some level because we all sing. We all dance. We all, you know, create.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Sally Fox, and I'm speaking with Isaac Slade, former lead singer for The Fray, now record store owner with Sidestack Records on Vashon. Yeah, so what led you to create the record store next door, a very cool venue that sells vinyl?
It was sort of a random circumstantial opportunity. I knew the landlords who owned that building, and they... sweet bottle creamery was in there. Glass bottle creamery was in there. They moved across the street. Standard Goods came in there. And then a month after Standard Goods was in there, another space opened up. So the landlords lost their tenant and they had a couple months to just kind of kill before it was like in November. So they were sort of downsizing and they put their like pop-up record store in there for 2 months. And they, like, one day they just asked if I wanted to work the counter for fun. They're like, I bet you haven't done retail in a minute. So I went in and ran the store, you know, every once in a while and just fell in love with the space, fell in love with the kind of reaction I was seeing people have of like, oh, my God, this is insane. Tell me this is going to stay. And I kept telling people, like, oh, unfortunately, you got to move fast. They're closing it up at the end of the year. You got 3 weeks left, you know, whatever. And I just kept seeing that reaction so many times. And I was also kind of in a place in my life where I was looking to sort of get back to work and step out of this kind of sabbatical I've been in for a long time. So all the stars aligned, and I called them and said, like, can I buy these records and take over? And they applauded it, and they were cheering me on. And so I kind of, without knowing what I was doing at all, the kids and I were sleeping under the tree on Christmas Eve. Everybody had fallen asleep and I just jumped online and like I bought the website and filed with the state at like 11:30 Christmas Eve while everybody was snoring. And I was like, what should I call it? Oh, I'll call it this. And then called some buddies and they're helping me run it now. But yeah, it was hilarious. Just a happenstance. And for a while people were like, what the hell are you doing? And then people started coming in and kind of seeing it and getting it. And the fact that we're open every day is so funny. People are like, they fold their arms. They're like, not every day. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Every day. They're like, well, we'll see if that lasts. And I was like, okay. I know you've been hurt before by other businesses that are randomly open and closed, but we're gonna do this. And they're like, well, we'll see. We'll see.
Oh my. Yeah. Well, it's a great addition to our community. And it's sort of walking in, there's a kind of honoring of the world of vinyl that a lot of, you know, it's like we've gone through a world and people let go of their records, but then people are coming in and saying, oh my goodness,
yeah.
Like I'm meeting an old friend again, yeah. And this is really fun.
I remember Cher.
And those album covers that were beautiful, you know?
Gorgeous.
And works of art in their own way, so yay, you know?
Cool.
I think people will... It gives people also a place where they can just come and look and enjoy. Because a lot of times you go to Thriftway because you're going to buy milk.
Yep.
But you go to a vinyl store because you just want to hang out and see what you might find or have the vibe
good.
And all.
Yeah. That's gorgeous.
Yeah. Any other creative ventures? Because you, in your bio, you referred to other entrepreneurial and creative ventures. Anything else you're cooking?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a scatterbrain. I have 50 things going kind of all the time. I got a bunch of entrepreneurial things I'm starting to kind of sneak into. I'm doing some nonprofit work around fighting human trafficking. Mm. I'm doing...
How did you choose that one?
That one was sort of a kind of a general priority my ex and I had, you know, when we were starting to really have enough money to give some away. We kind of picked that. You know, 15 years ago was kind of a priority. And then we started focusing our giving within that space to one organization. And then I've just been supporting that organization for 10 years. So it's more like they came to us. But yeah, I'm really passionate about that space. And then I also do, I'm thinking about getting back into music. I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but I've been dreaming about writing again and started writing. And it's been great.
There was a song I saw. There were a couple... outside of the fray, you recorded a couple things with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
They were beautiful.
Oh,
and they had a different energy about them. They weren't big rock, you know. You see yourself going in that direction? There was one you recorded in a church, I think.
Yep.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. My ex's name is Anna. She and I we were married for 20 years. So we went through kind of all of those fray years together. She married me when I was 46 grand in debt. She supported us for a year while I traveled in a van, not making money. And then probably 2 years after the band got on its feet, she and I got asked to play this Habitat for Humanity benefit. Big crowd. Jimmy Carter was there and Garth Brooks. It was insane. And we sort of got a taste for it. We loved it. We really enjoyed singing together. So we kind of dabbled in that, you know, parallel of my career the whole time. We've only played together probably 30 times, but it was always a joy and it was so fun. And now that we're split, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I think I have two or three different kind of genre directions I want to go. One is very pop, electronic, kind of quiet, death cabby sort of stuff. Another is like where the fray almost got to like a rock place, but we always stayed in pop. I want to just tip that over into rock a little bit more and learn how to yell and learn how to like tune my electric guitar down a little bit more. So I'm playing in C sharp instead of E. And I've been jamming with some metal dudes on the island that just like opened my eyes to the aggressive side of music, which has been great. So I kind of want to get softer and harder at the same time. But yeah, the first album I think I'm going to work on is this album called 1940. I'm writing it about these like 19 friends that I had out for my birthday, my 40th, a couple of years ago.
Sweet.
And I started working on a song for each one. It's probably a third of the way done, but I think that'll be the first one I chase.
Yeah. Last question. Your oldest child is 10, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He or she?
My 10-year-old is Judah, my son.
Judah. If Judah said, hey, Dad, I want to be a rock star or go into the entertainment industry in some big way, what would you say or what counsel would you give?
Well, first of all, Judah wants to get into weapon design engineering, and he has about 800 that he's designed. And my buddy, who's like special forces, he's like, some of these are actually pretty good. But my 7-year-old Evie she's been talking about wanting to be a pop star since she was like 4 or 3, which half of your life is pretty significant. So I have grappled with that with her, and she. She's a really good singer. She's a really good dancer. She's hilarious. She's a really good actress. And she, you know, who knows? But she certainly has a lot of the kind of the elements. So I do talk to her, and my ex talks to her a lot about, you know, what would that feed in her? What would that look like? Why does she want to do that? Why is she so dead set on it? And, you know, I would speak... I'd probably speak differently to a 7-year-old than I would a 15-year-old, and definitely different than I would to like a 33-year-old trying to pay the mortgage. But essentially, you know, I would have a cross-fading message. The younger they are, the more I would talk about the magic of it. The older they are, the more I would talk about how incredibly difficult it is to make money at it. But somewhere between the magic and the money, there's probably a sweet spot at the 15-year-old speech that I would give, which is... chase it as hard as you can. Make sure the songs are like vulnerable enough that they make you squirm a little bit. If they make you a little vulnerable and uncomfortable, then they're probably the right idea. It's not about making you look good. It's about drawing people back to them, their true selves. And if you're doing that, they're going to do it. And at the same time, you got to have a plan B and a plan C and hopefully a plan D, because there's odds are it's going to be a hobby that you can find solace in the hardest times. And that's a good thing. And odds are, I mean, because the odds are so stacked against musicians to ever make, you know, 60 grand a year from music, you also get to probably have the luxury of a lot of purity of your art, a lot of simplicity, and a lot of uncomplicated lady sits down with a guitar, a piece of paper, and a pen, and just makes versus, oh God, how do I deal with the pressure of trying to come up with another single? How do I deal with my marketing guy, you know, hammering me to do 600 interviews this month? How do I deal with my voice blowing out because I have 15 shows this week? I mean, all those things, if you do get the good fortune of grappling with that stuff, more power to you. It's worth it. And I'm so glad I did. And I had a plan B, plan C, plan D. I had a plan J probably, because I was sure the music wasn't going to ever pay. And then when it did, I was sure it was going to last 3 years, and I was going to go home and teach or something. And then when it took off, I think everybody was surprised, including, especially me. So I think what I've said to Evie is like, let's write a song and like, let's work on it. So we sit down and we write songs together. They're hilarious and awesome and deep and shallow and great.
Oh, it's so wonderful. Well, she sounds great. And how wonderful that she has life ahead of her and a dad who kind of gets the ropes and can help her find the balance and keep her soul going, no matter what direction she decides to go in. So
yeah, our song that we're working on right now is about this was her concept. It's about a hairdryer who's having like an identity crisis, and it woke up one day like being, you know, used by the lady who owns him, and he wants something more. And like, we're still exploring what he wants to be. Right now, I think she wants him to like aspire to be a pickle. And I'm just watching this brain like do things that humans, adults, like lose at age 14 or 20. And she's still got it. That sort of like fearless spark of like, why don't we do it about an inanimate object that wants to be another inanimate object? It's one of the funniest things I've ever written and worked on. Oh my God, it's so great. Our other tune we're working on with her friend Isla. They're talking about being a little pop duo. Isla's 7 too. Is all about mom. No, it's about like this really cash tight-fisted dad who like doesn't want to take the kids to the swimming pool because it's too much money. And the whole song is about the kids complaining that the dad is like too busy all the time to take them. And then it switches to like, but please, dad, you're amazing. And we noticed this amazing thing. And the dad's like, really? Oh, thanks. Hey, we should go swimming. oh my God, the kids' concepts are just, I mean, I've written with like very famous people and it's thrilling to write with kids just to see their fearlessness.
Well, seeing the look on your face, you know, and the joy in your eyes, I think, hey, that might end up influencing your music. You
it
never
has.
Know.
Absolutely. You know? It has.
Yeah, well, thanks so much. I know you got a busy life around here, and I really appreciate you getting up early and coming out.
Yeah.
And Vashon is just delighted to receive you. I'm talking officially in no official capacity, but it's really a joy. And thanks for your contribution to the arts organization. And
absolutely.
I can't wait to see what comes next.
Thanks, Sally.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.